Welcome to We Hold These Truths, America at 250. I'm Joe Donahue, along with Skidmore College constitutional scholar Bo Breslin. Historian H.W. Brands has spent decades bringing America's most influential figures vividly to life. The Jack Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin, Brands is the author of more than 30 books, including Pulitzer Prize finalists on Benjamin Franklin and Franklin Roosevelt. His latest American patriarch turns to the nation's first president, George Washington. Rather than treating Washington as an untouchable icon, Brands explores the ambition, discipline, and restraint that shaped both the man and the new republic. It's a biography that examines how Washington's leadership helped establish the political traditions that continue to define America today. It is a great pleasure for Bo and I to welcome H.W. Brands to this special roundtable. Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Joe.
Give us a sense of, with how much there is out there about George Washington, of what you felt was missing.
Well, to be honest, I didn't feel as though I had to fill a gap in the Washington literature. There's been a lot written on George Washington. I assume, however, that people who are inclined perhaps to pick up a book on George Washington will know the outlines of the story, but will not have read all the other biographies. So I really didn't feel obliged to figure out what Ron Chernow left unsaid, what Douglas Freeman left unsaid, 60 years ago, because most of my readers will not have read the whole bibliography. My general approach is, if a story is an important story, as the Washington story is, if it's a good story, and if I can do justice to it, then I'll find a readership.
H.W., let me give you a little bit more credit than you're giving yourself in this moment, because one of the things that I found fascinating about your book is that you talk more subtly about arguably the most important part of Washington's career, which was the two decisions to, quote unquote, walk away. Right? The decision to walk away as commander of the army and the decision ultimately to walk away as president of the United States when he didn't have to walk away. You say that they're not an insignificant part of his story, but you tell a much more subtle and nuanced and more complicated story about why he walked away. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. And I'll just add here, one of the reasons that I've taken so long to get to Washington is that his success was undramatic, and for that reason, a little bit hard to kind of figure out. So I've written about Franklin Roosevelt, and he led the country through the Great Depression. He led the world through World War II. So you know what he did. You know what the stakes are. You know sort of how he did it. I've written about Abraham Lincoln. Okay, so he's an obvious choice, and you know what he did. With Washington, yes, he did lead the country to victory in the Revolutionary War. And that's a big deal. But then that raises the question, well, how did he do it? And then and the story of Washington's presidency is quite striking, as will you point out, and I do point it out in the book, that the significant thing is that he didn't make more of it than it might have been. And so it took me a long time to get a handle on Washington. He had figured in some of my earlier books, but not as the main character. But a few years ago, I decided, well, there's this 250th anniversary coming up. So now, if I'm ever going to do it, now's the time to do it. And what I concluded about Washington is that his success owed to the absolutely most important thing that conduces to success in public life, but also the most nebulous thing. And that is, he had good judgment. He made good decisions. And how do you quantify that? How do you identify that ahead of time? If we could identify that ahead of time, then we wouldn't have so many failed cases of people being promoted to this office where it didn't turn out, people being elected to the presidency where it didn't turn out well. You never know good judgment until you see it in action. And even then, you have to see how things turn out. And in the case of Washington, it's absolutely crucial to his success that he wasn't ambitious in the way a lot of people who go into public life, either into military life or into political life, are ambitious. His life was very good before he became commander of the Continental Army. His life was very good before he became president of the United States. And that's really important. And it's kind of a commonplace in the hiring process that the people you want to hire are the ones who are not desperate for the job because they've got good jobs. They like what they're doing. And Washington, on a day-to-day basis, liked nothing better than being the master of Mount Vernon, of riding around his farms and experimenting with this seed and that kind of procedure. But he did feel this call to public service. He had been ambitious in a particular way from the time he was a young man. He wanted to develop a reputation as a man of honor and a man of principle. And in the class into which he was born, I write about the Virginia gentry in the book. This was one where you were expected to serve the public. You're wealthy enough, but you were supposed to, you would gain respect by doing respectable things. You would gain honorable by doing honorable things. And so this is what Washington did. Now, it turned out he had real gifts in the military line. He discovered this in his first experience under fire, where he got shot at and almost killed. And he wrote to his brother afterwards. He said, "I've heard the bullets whistle, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound." Well, if that's your reaction about having just, escaped victory by, escaped death, sorry, by, inches, you got the possibility of a military career ahead of you. I had earlier written on Ulysses Grant, and he had exactly the same reaction. And so Washington was at his best under fire. Now, so he's kind of an obvious choice eventually to head the Continental Army. And he leads the army to victory, and we can talk about that more and how it happened. But when he finished with that, he'd had enough. He didn't have any particular ambition to parlay that into political power because he had no political ambition. He eventually became president of the United States because people like Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson said, "We need you. Your country needs you." And he couldn't not answer the call. So it's a case of somebody knowing what his gifts were. And I would say, I mean, I really hesitate to say this because it's kind of the oldest story about Washington, but he did the right thing at the right time. He did what was expected of him. And one of the marks of this was that even in his day, he was almost universally esteemed. He was a member of this generation that included Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson and all those other people who were strong-minded, ambitious people. But every one of them, even including Franklin, they acknowledged that Washington had something that they didn't have. And so they might disagree with him, they might argue with him, but they always kind of deferred to him in a kind of, in a certain kind of moral sense.
You point out in the book that political office was driving him nuts. He had had enough, and he was having trouble with the press and just couldn't get out fast enough. But so when you talk about the preservation that Washington was interested in, it was ultimately his self-preservation, right?
It was that, but he had come to identify, as great people in a great moment tend to do, they identify themselves with the task that they're engaged in trying to accomplish. And Washington came to identify himself with this experiment in self-government. And he knew that America was not fighting simply for independence. He was fighting for the idea that people, any people, could govern themselves. And this is one of the reasons that he was willing to step back at the end of the Revolutionary War, because the whole idea was for people to govern themselves and not to be governed by some new strong man. If Washington had made himself King George I of America, he might have won the war, but he would have destroyed the whole point of the war. And he understood that very well. He understood, as did the soldiers and officers in his army, that they were engaged in this fight for American freedom, but it was also a fight for this challenge of world historic importance. And it was really the first time a country had declared itself just out of whole cloth, or just, on a day they just write this piece of paper, sign their names to it, we're now a country. But not only a country, but a new way of organizing society. Until then, from time immemorial until then, it was really rare when people thought they could govern themselves. There was the Roman Republic for the time that it was around, the Greek city-states, and so on. But for the most part, people had been governed by other people. Can people actually govern themselves? Can people be judges in their own case? Well, actually, we tend to think not. In our system of jurisprudence, you don't get to judge your own case, but that's really what we do when we try to govern ourselves. So Washington understood that this is what they were engaged in. And this is why This is why one of the moments I write about in the book is when Washington is relinquishing his command, when he tells his officer corps that he's going to give back his commission to the Continental Congress and he's going home to Mount Vernon. And he calls all the officers together. And there's this tearful parting because these men, who it's important to remember that the Continental Army was a small group by compared with modern armies. You know, Ulysses Grant had an army 10 times the size of Washington's, and Dwight Eisenhower had an army 100 times the size of George Washington's. But so he could gather all of his officers in a middle-sized tavern in New York, and they could knock back some wine, and they could say farewell. And one after the other, they came up and they shook and they embraced Washington's hand, and tears were shed on both parts because they realized that they had been through this really formative, the most exciting, the most compelling thing they would ever do in their lives. It had been 8 long years. It had been years of trial, of suffering. They had lost friends. They had suffered themselves. They had been cold. They'd been hungry, the whole thing. And they had survived. So it was a matter of personal survival. It was a matter of, we did this thing together. But it was also a case, as I'm alluding to what I had said before, they had done this thing that the world would remember, that, shoot, we would be talking about 250 years later. They had done this thing, assuming this is absolutely critical to the whole thing, assuming that they and their successor generations could continue to keep this experiment of self-government going. And this is one of the real lessons to take from the whole story. One of the reasons that Washington decided to leave after 2 terms, you're absolutely right, Joe, that he was fed up with politics. He wanted to get out of town as soon as he could. But he also understood that it would be a very bad example for the first president to become a president for life. And in fact, if he had accepted a third election, and died in 1799, as he did, then the precedent will not have been leave after 2 terms. It would have been get elected and serve for life. And that would have been a very different country that would have followed from that. So Washington understood that. He understood as much as his generation had done, now it's time to hand it off to the next generation, see what they could do with it.
HW, I have a quick cheeky question for you. And I'll say this to the listeners out there. One of the things that's great about the sweep of your writing and your academic career is that you've written on some of the most important people in American history, everybody from Washington to Ronald Reagan and FDR and Ulysses S. Grant and Abraham Lincoln. But the one thing that I love about it is you always seem to come back to the founding period. And one of your great books, of course, is the one on Benjamin Franklin. The title of that particular book is The First American. Now, what's interesting, this is the cheeky part of the question, is Jefferson writes to somebody in 1820 and calls Franklin our venerable patriarch. So what is interesting to me is you could use those titles interchangeably, Washington as the American patriarch, but also Franklin, and Washington as the first American, but also Franklin. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the use of titles and how they might be interchangeable?
Yeah, well, you know, it hadn't occurred to me when I was writing about Franklin that I might have called him the patriarch. The Jefferson reference didn't resonate with me. And then, of course, having used that title, I couldn't use it again, so I needed another one. But, I mean, it just occurred to me something that you said. The patriarch, in the way I use it about Washington, and so I'll explain it in just a moment, also applies to Franklin in this regard. So for patriarch, I was thinking, you know, the father of his country, as he's often called. But I was also had the notion of the biblical patriarchs in mind, you know, preeminently Moses. And the thing about Moses is he leads the Israelites out of Egypt to the promised land. But he's not allowed to enter the promised land. And this applied essentially to both Washington and to Franklin. And in Franklin's case, because he dies, just as the Republic under the new Constitution is getting underway. But with Washington, I probe it a little bit further, because one of the secrets of Washington's success was he lived according to the rules and expectations of an earlier period, of the age of aristocracy. America never had a full-blown hereditary aristocracy, but the gentry into which Washington was born lived by those rules. And the coin of the realm there was the esteem in which you were held by the other members of the gentry. And so Washington lived at a time when ordinary people expected to defer to the ones they would call their betters. And so Washington set himself up in that way. He did not allow himself to be familiar with other people. He didn't talk much. He almost never told jokes or laughed. He spoke only when it was necessary to speak. So he set himself apart, and he lived at a time when Americans were willing to go along with it. But this new system that he had helped create, that he had been the father of creating, this new Republican system was one that didn't allow that. If Washington had had to compete for the presidency, the way every president after him did, he never would have gone into politics. He was happy to have the presidency handed to him on a platter. It was for him a victory lap for what he had done in the Revolutionary War. And, you know, Washington's critics said that either he or his followers were trying to set him up to be a king. He did not want to be king. Some of his supporters probably wish he would have been king. I think he would have been a really good king. He would have been a good example of somebody who knows how to make decisions and also who is able to put the interests of the nation ahead of himself. But he didn't have the sharp elbows for politics that were necessary for success in a republic, and also the willingness to consider himself no better than everybody else, because America's quickly entering the age of democracy, the age of equality. And Washington was really of a different era. He was the last of the aristocrats. And so it's, you know, just as well he left office and died when he did.
Here is a man who did not sign the Declaration of Independence, but he's got a great alibi. So that's that's a thing. But talk a little bit about, because you write in the book beautifully about how he addresses the troops a few days later and telling them about what happened on July 4th. But of ultimately his imprint on that document and what did happen on July 4th.
Washington became commander of the Continental Army in June of 1775. This is 13 months before the Declaration of Independence. And he has a really complicated task. He's sent off to Boston, where the British have hunkered down. And the Continental Forces, the militia that's going to become the Continental Army, they have besieged the British in Boston. He knows what he's fighting against. He's fighting against the British, but he doesn't know what he's fighting for. And he doesn't know what to tell his soldiers. Washington's leadership of his army was very much a moral leadership in the sense of, this is what we are fighting for. This is why we're doing what we're doing. And until the Declaration of Independence, he didn't know what to tell his men. He could say, we're fighting to defend our rights as what? As Englishmen, as Americans, he didn't know what the answer to that question was. And so it was with great relief that he learned that the Continental Congress had adopted the Declaration of Independence. And now he had this message, and he had the declaration read to his troops. So that, okay, this is what we are fighting for. And now he could say, we are fighting for independence. We are fighting for freedom. And it gave his message much greater resonance than it had before. And so, for example, in the dark days in the middle of the war at Valley Forge, preeminently, when Washington's trying to keep his army from melting away. His soldiers are hungry, they're cold, they're sick, and many of them want to go home, but he gets them to stay. He gets them to stay partly by the force of his example. He could have gone home to Virginia. Officers often went home during the winter when there was no fighting. The British were snugly housed in Philadelphia, but he stuck around. And so he would go out every day and he would supervise the troops and see what was going on. And they could see him. His soldiers could see him. And they could see that, you know, here's a guy who had, you know, more to lose than any of us because he had more to start with. And he didn't have to do this. They knew that he was serving without pay. He was doing this for the good of the country. And when they decided not to leave, not to desert, it was partly for the cause. That was true. But it was also, and this is true again and again in wars with soldiers and why they fight. They were fighting as much for him as they were for the cause. They didn't want to let down their country, but they really didn't want to disappoint their commander.
H.W., we're it's an honor to have you on the show, and I want to build off of Joe's question for our last question for you, and that we're asking everybody in this series, all eight people in this series, roughly the same question, which is more indispensable for the story of America at 250, the Declaration or the Constitution?
Oh, boy. I would say the Declaration, honestly. And the reason is that once the United States has declared independence, and the Declaration only really takes effect when Washington's army wins the war, because you only accomplish what you accomplish when the other side says enough, we're done. So the Declaration creates an independent country. The United States had a first try at a constitution, the Articles of Confederation, and they didn't quite fit the moment. They worked okay during the war, but in the peacetime, they needed to be strengthened. If the second go round, the Constitution hadn't worked, well, in fact, I had to point out, the Constitution didn't work as written. They were amended 10 times right away, and then 11 and 12, you know, within a few years. So once you have the assertion that people can govern themselves, then exactly how you do it is something that you can modify over time. I'll add something about as much respect as I have for the Constitution. What the Constitution did was to establish an approach to governance. So much of what we do on a day-to-day basis in Washington and Congress with the Supreme Court and all this other stuff is not written down in the Constitution. It's stuff that is developed over time. And it developed because we have this mindset. And the mindset is we are a nation of laws. Now, we get to write the laws. And the laws include the Constitution because we can change the Constitution. We've done it 27 times. So if we've got the independent country, then I think we can get the government we need. And I will say we've been getting the government we need ever since. So we've been rewriting the Constitution many times. We only wrote the Declaration of Independence once.
H.W. Brands is the author of the new book, American Patriarch, The Life of George Washington. It is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a great honor to have you on the program.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Bo.
H.W. Brands is the author of the new book, American Patriarch. It is published by Doubleday. Stay tuned. Bo Breslin will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Rick Atkinson. It's next on We Still Hold These Truths, America at 250 on WAMC.
Kathy, I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. Took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said, be careful, his bow tie is really a camera.
Welcome back. I'm Bo Breslin. Award-winning historian Rick Atkinson has spent decades bringing pivotal moments in American history to life through richly researched, compelling narrative. His latest book, The Fate of the Day, The War for America, Fort Ticonderoga to Charleston, 1777 to 1780, is the second volume of his acclaimed Revolution trilogy, chronicling the critical middle years of the American Revolution as George Washington's army struggles to survive and the fight for independence hangs in the balance. Rick Atkinson is a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, earning honors for national reporting, public service as part of the Washington Post staff, and history for An Army at Dawn. It's a pleasure to welcome Rick Atkinson, the greatest living military historian, in my opinion, to the roundtable. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Bo. That's very nice of you.
Rick, I have so many questions, and I know we need to limit the amount that I have. So let me start by quoting you back to you and asking you to explain. When describing your second installment in the Revolution trilogy, The Fate of the Day, a fantastic book, you admit to one hope, and this is an exact quote from you, to restore the emotional connection between 21st century Americans and those who took part in this great struggle 250 years ago. Can you talk about what you mean by the emotional connection and what would that look like?
You know, Bo, I think that a lot of Americans, maybe most Americans, have a view of the Revolution as sort of a faded, gauzy lithograph, sepia tones. It wasn't like that. It was violent, very violent, and bloody, and intense. It lasted for 8 years. It becomes not only a skirmish on the literal of the American seaboard, eastern seaboard, but it becomes a global war fought on four continents and seven seas. It's a monumental thing. And I think that we, by virtue of seeing it in soft sepia tones, have lost some of the emotional connection to it. I think that it's important to recognize that the essence of every war, including this one, our first war, is suffering, sacrifice, pain. It's ultimately about dead boys and sobbing mothers. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do in these recent books that I've done.
And you've called it quite accurately something that a lot of people don't remember, and that is a civil war, right? You're very good at explaining that it's a civil war. And can you describe how viewing it as a civil war changes our understanding of the founding, your understanding of the founding?
Yeah, it makes it a lot more complicated, for one thing. And I think that's good. Life is complicated generally, and the past is complicated. And if we try to recognize that and we try to understand it, I think it's easier to relate to in an odd way. If we see Washington and the other founders as men and women who have feet of clay, like all of us, who are not tall marble statues in a statuary hall someplace, it makes them, I think, closer to us, makes it easier to understand. The revolution is a civil war on several levels. It's a civil war, obviously, between the mother country, Britain, and those 13 fractious, rebellious colonies. It's a civil war between Americans. About 20% of the 2 million white Americans are committed loyalists. They don't want any part of independence. They reject the idea of armed rebellion against their lawful monarch. And that aspect of the Civil War gets nastier as the war goes on. Most of the fighting for the last couple of years is in the South, and it really anticipates the Civil War, not in the causes of the conflict, but in the internecine nastiness, brother on brother, father against son, and so on. And then finally, it's a civil war among Indian tribes. The Six Nations of the Iroquois in your neck of the woods, the Haudenosaunee, have gotten along quite well for a century or more. They have a compact that allows the tribes to live in comity together. And the revolution forces them to choose sides. And four of those six are going to align with the British, two are going to align with the rebels, and they fight each other. And it gets pretty nasty also. There's a lot of Indian on Indian killing that goes on. So, you know, you put those all together and what you've got is really one big, ugly civil war that we don't think of typically when we reflect on the American Revolution.
Yeah, and as you said, led by both civilian military, led by folks with flaws and anxieties and all of the types of things. You're the greatest military historian alive today, but I'm going to ask you about civilian life, the civilian folks in the revolution. Jefferson's taken a beating in the last, say, generation, right? So he's been called a hypocrite and so on. Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which understanding the full Jefferson or understanding the full Washington? You've said that Washington wasn't a great strategist or he wasn't a great military. He was a great military leader, but he wasn't great on the battlefield strategy, although a little bit better than Eisenhower. Can you talk about the way in which history in your lifetime has changed and how the marble statues of the American founding have been tarnished?
Yeah, Bo, I think that's an important part of it. The Washington, during his lifetime at Mount Vernon, and he died there in December of 1799, owned at least 577 slaves. Jefferson had even more at Monticello. You can't square that circle morally. You have to accommodate it somehow. We have to recognize that this is part of the world they lived in. It's part of who they were. We can condemn them, I think, because both of them knew that slavery was wrong. Washington at least freed the slaves that he personally owned in his will. Jefferson, you know, only a handful. He tended to be related to those that he freed. But my feeling is that in trying to understand why that's part and parcel of who they are, why Washington, despite being a pretty mediocre tactician, he gets his butt handed to him at New York, the Battle of Long Island, again at Brandywine. Elsewhere, he's less than stellar on the battlefield. And yet he's a war-winning general. He's a very capable general. and in my estimation, worthy of the plauded father of the country. Jefferson, in a similar way, Jefferson is kind of a mediocre governor, first of all. He's the owner of all those slaves and has other defects as a man, as a politician. And yet, he's the author of one of the greatest documents in our language. He's the, you know, he's the progenitor of many things that we believe in dearly. The establishment of the Republic owes a lot to Jefferson and Madison and others who are deeply flawed. What does that tell us? It tells us that it's complicated. My friend Ken Burns has a neon light in his studio in New Hampshire, and it says it's complicated. And he applies it to all of the films that he makes, and certainly to the terrific film that he made on the American Revolution. That, I think, should be heartening to us, to know that, first of all, they're imperfect, to know that they managed to overcome not only their vicissitudes and the trials of their time, but their flaws, their defects, to rise above them in a pretty significant way. And so this is all part and parcel of the grand mess that we call the American story.
That's right. I'm always struck by the fact that, you know, I'll stick with Jefferson one second, then I'll ask you another question. I'm always struck by the fact that if you trace and you do a great job of this, if you trace Jefferson's career, he not only wrote, if you're Walter Isaacson, the greatest sentence ever written with "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal," but then he goes on to be ambassador to France, secretary of state, vice president of the United States, founded a university. He accomplished a lot of stuff.
Amen, Bo. Yeah, he accomplished a lot of stuff. He lived to be an old man. He and Adams famously die on July 4th, 1826, as old men. At that point, reconciled to one another after having a falling out. And, you know, I think when you look back on what they accomplished, meaning the founders writ large, you have to say, okay, well done. Be thou at rest, as they say at West Point.
That's right. Okay, now for a fun question. This is the problem for you as a public intellectual and one of the greatest historians. I can find a lot of stuff about you. So more than a decade ago, you were interviewed by the Journal of the American Revolution, and you had a perfectly appropriate answer to a broad question. They asked, what has been the biggest revelation about the American Revolution that you have thus far discovered? Do you remember what you said?
I probably talked about the British.
This is your quote. Some revelations are best not revealed until the moment is ripe. This was a decade ago. Is there a more ripe moment than the 250th? What's that? What's the answer to the great revelation?
Yeah, isn't that a clever non-answer? I'm now two-thirds of the way through this project. I've been at it since 2013, so I've been in it for 13 years. And the thing that is most revelatory to me, relatively new in this field as of 2013, but now steeped in it for more than a dozen years, is the British. I spent a lot of time for both volumes, as I did in writing about World War II for 15 years, in British archives, particularly British National Archives in Kew outside of London. I was at the British Library twice last summer, trying to understand who George III was. He's not the sinister ninny who prances across the stage every night in Hamilton. He's not the tyrant that Jefferson calls him in the Declaration. He's not the royal brute that Thomas Paine calls him in Common Sense, published in January 1776. He's a child of the Enlightenment. He's a constitutional monarch. He's an avid supporter of the arts and the sciences. He too is complicated. And trying to understand why he's waging war for 8 years, as it turns out, across 3,000 miles of open ocean against his own people in the age of sail is something that I still wrestle with. I think I've got a much better handle on him than I did when I started this. But to understand why he and Lord North, the Prime Minister, and Sandwich, head of the Admiralty, George Germain, who's the American Secretary, he's really the Robert McNamara of the war, why they're doing what they're doing, why they think that they need to spend all the blood and treasure that they're spending to suppress the American impulse to for independence. That has been, I think, a perpetual surprise to me.
Yeah, you've called it, you've called the British beguiling in other conversations. Can I ask you about another beguiling figure and get your thoughts on it? Because, of course, WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, spans a lot of area, but of course it spans Saratoga too.
Yeah.
And we care about the Battle of Saratoga up here. And of course, Benedict Arnold was a major player, a beguiling figure. As a military historian with some serious bona fides about tactics and strategy, tell me what you think about Benedict Arnold.
Look, Bo, I think he's the best tactical leader on either side the first couple of years of the war. He is born to lead other men in the dark of night. Washington, who has an excellent eye for subordinate talent, so he sees another New Englander named Nathaniel Greene, who's this lapsed Quaker and anchor smith from Rhode Island, and somehow intuits that Greene is going to be second only to Washington as the indispensable man in the Continental Army. And even before Washington actually meets Arnold, which is early in the war, he hears about him and he's interested in him. And he recognizes that this is a beguiling guy. I mean, Arnold had been involved in one of the first scraps of the Revolution when he and another irascible New Englander, Ethan Allen, go together, bickering the whole way, to seize Fort Ticonderoga from the small British garrison that's there. Washington appoints Arnold as one of the commanders commanding the eastern wing of the invasion of Canada, as a colonel leading 1,000 men through the Maine wilderness in the late fall of 1775, one of the great feats of arms in American military history. He's wounded badly at Quebec. The invasion fails. The commander, Richard Montgomery, is killed. And yet Arnold helps to usher the American invasion force, which is bedraggled and riddled with smallpox, chased by the British back up the St. Lawrence River, back into New York to Lake Champlain, where he fights a naval battle against the Royal Navy. You know, because he, as a Connecticut merchant, he has learned how to sail. He's learned how to put together ships. He knows how to build ships. And he, you know, he's defeated on Lake Champlain at Valcour Island, but he delays the British long enough that it upsets their plans for that late fall of 1776. And all of that is going to lead to Saratoga. The British are delayed in coming into the Hudson River Valley, and one thing leads to another. And at Saratoga, both battles of Saratoga in September and October of 1777, it's Arnold who's at the cannon's mouth. He's the guy on the battlefield. Horatio Gates, Major General, is the overall commander of the American forces there, but it's Arnold who's on the battlefield, and he's quite dazzling at it, particularly the second battle, when again he's badly wounded. He's shot in the left leg again. This time he's really seriously injured, and he's going to be months in the hospital recuperating, and in that time, he's brooding. And he's a brooder.
Right.
And sure. we all know where this is leading. It's leading to Arnold being a synonym for treason.
That's right.
Again, what a complicated, tormented figure. Hard to get inside his head. Hard to fully understand why he does what he does.
Right.
But he is really a fascinating character.
All right, you ready for the unfair part of the interview, this rapid fire section of the interview?
Go for it.
Okay. You've spoken repeatedly about the value of luck in warfare. And one of the luckiest figures is Washington, right? He dodges bullets repeatedly and almost miraculously survives the entire conflict. Would we have a country if he had died at the Battle of Princeton or the Battle of Brandywine or the Battle of Monongahela in the Seven Years' War?
Yeah, that's when he was a young pup. I think we don't win at Yorktown in 1781. My guess is that ultimately we extract ourselves from the British Empire. The rate of growth of America, it's doubling in size every 25 years. It's four times the rate of Britain's growth. It's the largest population rate of growth. It's unseen in European history. So I think we're going to get it eventually, but it's not going to be as soon as it was, and it takes 8 years without Washington.
I think you answered this question, but I'm going to ask you to confirm. So the question that I had for you is, who's the most indispensable military man on the Patriot side not named George Washington?
Yeah, it's definitely Nathaniel Greene. Yeah. Because not only does he show his chops as a battlefield commander at Valley Forge, this is early 1778, where the American Army supply system has collapsed. 2,000 American soldiers die there of malnutrition, of disease, of neglect. Washington turns to Greene and says, I need you to be my quartermaster general.
Yeah.
Greene says, I don't want to. Nobody in history has ever heard of a quartermaster general, quote unquote. And Washington says, you gotta, I need you to do this. And out of loyalty to Washington, to the army, to the cause, Greene does it for 2.5 years. He's great at it. He doesn't solve all the problems by any means, but he puts it on a more even keel. And then when the war shifts into the South, he's put back into battlefield command. He is the theater commander in the South. He loses every battle he fights, and yet he wins the war. He's a better tactician than Washington. He does it by bleeding and tormenting the British and wearing them down, both wearing down the military and ultimately wearing down British political will at home. So he's the indispensable guy.
Okay, last rapid fire one. Then we have one final question that we're asking all of our people that we're interviewing. Here's the last rapid fire one. We've heard you talk a lot about Eisenhower and Washington. My question is, who had the steeper learning curve in the moment?
That's a good question. Pondered the two of them because they have a lot in alike, despite the fact being completely different in their backgrounds. I have to say that Washington does. He's been out of uniform for 16 years. He's only had 5 years of military experience as a Virginia militia colonel, always under superior British command in the French and Indian War. There's a lot that he never learned during that time in the Virginia militia. He doesn't know much about cavalry or artillery and so on. And he's a Virginian. He's commanding a largely New England militia army, and they're from different countries. He's got nothing good to say about quote unquote dirty New Englanders. That's how he refers to them privately. So that's a much steeper learning curve. Eisenhower, has been in uniform since 1915 when he graduates from West Point. And even though he's got a lot to learn too, when he takes over command of the combined Anglo-American force invading North Africa in 1942, he's been at it for quite a while. So it's definitely Washington. Good question, though.
Okay. My final question is one where, as I said, we're asking all the people we interview, which is more critical to the story of America at 250, the Declaration or the Constitution?
Oh, well, I would say to America 250, if we're celebrating the period of 1775 to 1783, it's the Declaration. But if you're talking about everything that comes subsequently in the creation of the Republic and where we are today, then it's the Constitution. That's the roadmap. That's the bedrock. The Declaration, though, enunciates what it is we're about. Now, there's a lot of silly stuff in it. The Bill of Particulars against the British is propaganda.
Yeah.
And some of it is plausible and defensible. And some of it is not.
Of course, Jefferson sort of made some of the stuff up.
He did. And not to mention the fact that a third of what he had written in the original draft is excised by Congress writing as, an editorial committee of the whole, including some ridiculous stuff about how it was the king who made us have slavery here.
Right.
Come on. But as you say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, blah, 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 blah. It's magnificent.
It is.
And it's a propulsion system. And it's a declaration of intent, a declaration of common cause. It's a declaration on many levels.
You must be doing a ton of these conversations because there's nobody better to talk about America at 250 and the American Revolution. Rick Atkinson, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Bo. I'm doing a lot, but none as fun as this one has been.
Bo Breslin, speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Rick Atkinson. His latest book is The British Are Coming, the graphic edition, Volume 1, the first half of the New York Times bestselling The British Are Coming, the opening volume in Atkinson's trilogy about the American Revolution.
The British are coming, the British are coming.
Now the ride of Paul Revere set the nation on its ear, and the shot at Lexington heard round the world. When the British fired in the early dawn, the War of Independence had begun. The die was cast, the rebel flag unfurled, and on to Concord marched the foe to seize the arsenal there, you know, waking folks and searching all around. Till our militia stopped them in their tracks. At the old North Bridge, we turned them back and chased those redcoats back to Boston town. And the shot heard round the world was the start of the revolution. The men were ready on the move. Take your powder, take your gun, report to General Washington. Hurry, men, there's not an hour to lose. Now at famous Bunker Hill, even though we lost, it was quite a thrill. The rebel Colonel Prescott proved he was wise. Outnumbered and low on ammunition, as the British stormed his position, he said, hold your fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Though the next few years were rough, General Washington's men proved they were tough. Those hungry, ragged boys would not be beat. One night they crossed the Delaware, surprised the Hessians in their lair, and at Valley Forge they just bundled up their feet.
Now the shot heard round the world was the start of the revolution. The men were ready on the move. Take your blanket, take your son, report to General Washington. We've got our rights and now it's time to prove.
Showed such determination that they won the admiration of countries across the sea like France and Spain, who loaned the colony ships and guns and put the British on the run and the Continental Army on its feet again. And though they lost some battles too, the Americans swore they'd see it through. Their raiding parties kept up hit and run. At Yorktown, the British could not retreat. Bottled up by Washington and the French fleet. Cornwallis surrendered, and finally we had won.
Hooray! I'm a shot heard round the world. To the end of the revolution, the Continental rabble took the day. And the father of our country beat the British there at Yorktown and brought freedom to you and me and the USA. God bless America.
We still hold these truths. America at 250 will continue tomorrow with historian Michael Auslan on how the Declaration of Independence made America, and a special book pick segment focusing on American history with Northshire Bookstore's Mike Hare. This program was written and curated by Joe Donahue and Bo Breslin. It was produced by Madeline Reynolds. Bailey James is our engineer. I'm Joe Donahue. Stay tuned now for Midday Magazine.